Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Homegrown, Engaged Cultural Criticism by Bell Hooks and Amalia Mesa Baines, narrated by Adenrale Ojo. Preface to the New Edition. Imagination plays a vital role in the struggle for liberation globally. It is our imaginative skill which we bring to creative work that promotes, enhances, and sustains democracy and individual freedom. What we cannot imagine cannot come into being. When I first saw work by Amalia Mesa Baines, I was awed by the way in which she gathered a diverse body of material to create a geography of the heart, mapping her life story. Part of that imaginative journey is the migratory movement of her ancestors. Their immigration expresses the hopes and dreams of folk making home place here in the U.S., yet never forgetting their deep ancestral roots. Like Amalia, I began my art practice focusing on my ancestors in my home place, Kentucky. Even though Amalia and I are both academics, our true calling has been to the world of art making, primarily linking creativity to social justice. When I first considered a conversation with Amalia, it was a serious crossing of boundaries. We have few conversations between Latinas and African American women. So often we are speaking about our relation to whiteness. Our conversation has focused primarily on art and cultural politics because, once again, this is a world of critique and practice that women of color rarely inhabit. Imagine with us our joy in speaking to one another. What a radical intervention! Interventions like this can only happen in a democracy where free speech and creativity is valued. Right now, there is perhaps no other time in our nation's history where we desperately need to highlight and celebrate the role of the imagination as a transformative force that can help us make a world where all people, especially those migrating from troubled countries and coming here to make home place, can live fully and freely. Bell Hooks. Preface. What might Black women say to Chicana women? We grieve with you, and we want ceremonies of reconciliation that link our goddesses and gods to each other, patterning new codices of forgiveness and triumph, sisters of the corn silk and sisters of the yam. We petition the basket weavers to dream a new pattern of our knowing and loving that binds the permanent impermanence of our footprints in the sand. M. Jackie Alexander, Pedagogies of Crossing. Bell. Homegrown Engaged Cultural Criticism is the culmination of an informal collaboration that began almost 10 years ago, a time when there was tremendous excitement about questioning Western domination, Western hegemony, and the biases in education. Amalia, when you and I met, the areas you and I work in, cultural criticism, art making, creative writing, teaching, were undergoing tremendous growth and transformation, largely due to the interventions and work of people of color. And you and I shared the sense that we were moving forward in anti-racist, pro-woman struggles. It seemed that the movements we were invested in were responding to pressures to be less white, less racist, and less sexist. What has become more difficult since we met in the 1990s is that much of the movement's work and energy has been undermined by the growing state, fascism, and the complacency of people who benefited from movements for radical change. We have entered a period of grave silence, censorship, and violence. Amalia, I agree. In some of my young students, I see a deeper sense of hopelessness. And for good reason. We are living in desperate times. But I think the conversation you and I have kept up over the years is very promising. We are refusing to be silenced or pitted against each other, and so are many others who are working for peace, justice, compassion. Bell, I agree. You know we called the book Homegrown because you know how homegrown food is really better for you. This conversation should nurture others. Part of why we are doing and want to publish our conversation rather than our essays is to speak to people who aren't necessarily essay readers and who aren't necessarily in academic institutions, but who are, or have the potential to be, organic intellectuals. People who critically think and engage in dialectical exchange wherever they are. Amalia, the term homegrown is also relevant to both of our upbringings. When I think about the pláticas, or the little discussions, there have always been models of this kind of exchange in the Latino community. From ordinary storytelling to corridos, which are these running historical songs. So, if you like, in some way we found ourselves in this homegrown model, because it had resonance for each of us, as we hope it will for the folks we are hoping to reach. Bell. And by actions like these, which are forms of activism, we repudiate the notion that as cultural workers and intellectuals, we are at odds with the world that we come from. And I agree with you. In this project, we're thinking about solidarity and the links between Black culture and Latino culture. Certainly, the mainstream discourse about Black-Latino relationships is very negative. We're always hearing that we have nothing in common. Amalia, we're at a point where many of these so-called differences are constructed, precisely because there are systems that benefit from our lack of solidarity around labor, immigration, education, and cultural rights. And they set in place the terminology and technology of division long ago. For instance, if you use the term Hispanic, your Spanish upbringing is privileged and your African and Indian are neutralized. All of these connections are unacknowledged, and their absence keeps us from seeing our similarities and foregrounds our differences. Bell, I don't even think the mass media is interested in our differences as they pertain to the specificity of our cultural locations. They want all people of color to be defined in relationship to whiteness. For this reason, attention is always paid to political splits between people of color. It's also simply true that African Americans have not taken strong stands in support of bilingual education, and many conservative African Americans buy into anti-immigration racism. Amalia. And in cities like Los Angeles, enormous political complexities are reduced to coverage suggesting that Blacks support a white candidate who may not even be progressive because he would defeat a Mexican or Chicano candidate who might privilege other Chicanos and exclude Blacks. That's all we hear. This is happening in lots of places where historically we have lived side by side, done similar jobs, and have intermarried. This is happening in places where there are deep and rooted communities intertwined and interdependent. Bell, that's precisely why this conversation is itself a form of activism. It's our resistance to that idea of separation. We do have differences. But our commonalities are just as strong, and they represent hope for resistance and freedom. Homegrown is an expression. It's a declaration and a bearing witness of that solidarity. It is a denial of the notion, the false assumption, that we are not connected. Amalia, we are connected. 1. Family. Bell. My earliest childhood experiences were shaped by fundamentalist Christian beliefs. As much as anything else, they framed what girls could or could not do. For instance, on Sunday, girls couldn't wear pants, we couldn't play music, and we couldn't walk across the pulpit. The pulpit was considered a sacred space that a female of any age could not walk across because she would defile it. In church between Sunday school and the morning service, I'd see all these boys running around and crossing the pulpit, but girls were always stopped. It was an early indoctrination into sexist thinking. Amalia. My family life was totally shaped by Catholicism, a hybrid of Mexican and U.S. Catholicism, as it included Irish priests from Ireland. There was this strange kind of mix of oratory and liturgy and beauty, but it was certainly fundamentalist. Catholicism belonged to the altar boys. There are altar girls now, but not then. So the fact that women maintained home altars or yard shrines posed alternatives to the conventional norm. Belle, whereas my mother's church going was very tied with her class mobility. In fact, she wanted to get away from the Pentecostal tent meetings that working class and poor people often attended. She wanted us to belong to a church that was modern, and for her, this meant sedate and no shouting and jumping for joy. The church only had power, but not all of it. Amalia, was it still Baptist? Belle, yes, all the black churches were Baptists. But Mama still wanted to rise in her class position. And this meant involvement in a church where there wasn't a lot of shouting or emotional release. In our church, there was one day, Communion Sunday on the first of the month, when people could give testimony and sing in the old ways. Elderly folk in the church continued to shout, but shouting was something that my mother's generation had begun to see as unseemly. Amalia. My mother also played a pivotal role in my Catholic upbringing, partly because her mother took her to a Catholic convent school and enrolled her as a student, and she didn't come back for. The school took her in as an orphan. As a result, my mother had a very intense devotional relationship to the church. Yet by the time we were born, she and my father were practicing birth control. For people of their generation and background, this was almost unheard of. And we were really different because there was only my brother and I. All of our other family members and relatives had 5 and sometimes even 10 kids. Belle, like my family, 6 girls and 1 boy. Where did you grow up? Amalia, this was in Santa Clara, California. My dad came when he was a little boy during the Mexican Revolution around 1917. There were work furlough programs then, and Mexicans were going to Denver and to Pueblo, Colorado to work. My mother came across with her mom on a day pass in the 1920s to do domestic work on the American side. Both of them ended up staying here. They didn't have papers for many years, but later they finally got them. However, this meant that for many years they lived in a very isolated way, as many undocumented people do. They were always careful to stay to themselves and not break rules. As a result, their community was tightly circumscribed, except for the church. But once my mother started practicing birth control, she couldn't attend services anymore. So attending church became my responsibility. I was the little emissary. I would attend church and would come back and report. I would tell everything that happened. I would save the little brochures, the church newsletter, and I would cut out the pictures in the little church newsletters of the religious images. And they were, you know, really famous religious paintings. Those were my first images of art, really. Belle, I've written about this. For many African-American working-class people, the first art we encounter is religious iconography. In my childhood, all I saw were the cheap reproductions of Leonardo and Michelangelo, Amalia, Caravaggio, Belle, all of that. But I was not born into an atmosphere where art was discussed. Neither my grandparents nor my parents talked about art or the imagery we saw, which in fact was the juxtaposition of family photographs and religious iconography, prints of, you know, religious scenes. Amalia, We had holy cards and sometimes little books which depicted the lives of the saints. For me, the lives of the saints were like soap operas. They were fantastical. Lucy was blinded with her eyes on the little plate that she carried. San Sebastian was shot through with arrows. They were really very graphic, physical, and even sexual. I think that's why everyone loved their stories. And I always thought that the saints were like this big extended family, and through them, we seemed to be related to God, Jesus, to Mary, and all these intriguing people. These images were also part of that relationship to religion, not spirituality. Belle, that's how I came to art, thinking about religious and family images, and then getting into the public school. I attended our little all-black school where art classes were offered. The good fortune of that time was that everyone took art classes. In those days, studying art was okay. Amalia, did you feel that you had an aptitude from the beginning, that you could draw well? Did you like to copy pictures? How did you know art was a cultural practice for you? Belle, I couldn't draw well at all. I wanted to draw well, and I took classes, worked really hard, but I didn't have an innate gift. Among working-class black folks, if you could draw well, people encouraged you. Amalia, that's why I was asking about your aptitude, because that's what some of my relatives picked up on. I'm in the third generation of artists in my family, on my father's side. There are my great uncles, my uncles, and in my generation, there's like 5 or 6 of us. In the generation after us, there's even more. And I had an aptitude. I had a gift. People saw it right away and encouraged me. My father had a brother and an uncle who were talented and made things, so he knew that I would become an artist. That's why they supported my work, even though they didn't think it would be a job or way of life. Belle, my father had an elderly first cousin in Chicago who painted dark oil portraits of nude women. He was the first artist I knew, my cousin Skylar. Even his name was exotic. And in my teens, my parents let me go to Chicago and I saw his work. I was shocked because it was all nudes. Amalia, what did other people say in the family? Belle, they saw his practice as weird. They thought the fact that he painted and saw himself as an artist was a cover for laziness. He wore beret and spent time alone in a basement studio dreaming and making art. Amalia, he was a bohemian. Belle, totally. He affirmed my interest in art, even though I did not draw well. Skylar encouraged this passion, and so did my high school art teacher, Mr. Harrell. I've written a lot about my high school art teacher because he really encouraged me. He saw me as a potential artist, and he displayed my work and awarded me prizes. My parents were opposed to this interest because there was no money for luxuries. When I painted, I could only paint during school hours using the school's resources. And when I wanted to enter one of my paintings into one of the art shows, I had to have work framed to enter. My parents said, "Sorry, you can't do this. We're not made of money, and we don't think there's a need for this." I had painted this very primitive portrait of a little boy, and my parents couldn't understand it as art. It wasn't, Amalia, representational enough. Belle, the world of abstract art was just weird to them. But my art teacher helped me to gather scraps of wood, and we created a primitive frame so that my work could be in the show. I remember my picture hanging in the show, and my parents were proud of the fact that I'd won 3rd place. But this did not mean they supported my desire to make art. Amalia, since making art was part of my family, they were willing to commit whatever they could afford. When I was very young, maybe 7 or 8, there was a back porch on our house where the dog stayed, and there was a washing machine, the kind you cranked by hand. They set up a little easel there. By then, my father was no longer working in the cannery. He might have been in the grocery business. So he knew people at the store, and he would go to the meat market and get rolls of butcher paper. When he got home, he'd put rocks on the paper to flatten it out, and that became my art paper. When I went to high school, they bought me a painting set. Because it was very expensive, it was a big deal. Even then, I saw art as a kind of doorway one enters, which can lead to freedom. Sometimes people try to keep the door shut, and you have to bang to get in. Sometimes people shove you through the door because they're so sure you should go there. Unfortunately, in high school, I didn't get along with my art teachers because they wanted me to make work in a certain kind of way. I didn't want to do it. I vividly remember one of my teachers marking my image to show me how to do it correctly. I tore it up and left the class. Of course, I was sent to the office for being rude to the teacher, and I kept saying, "But he was rude to me. He marked on my drawing." No one thought I had that kind of authorship yet, so it was not mine. Belle, by comparison, my high school art teacher was an Italian immigrant. He understood what it meant to be an outsider. Amalia, a white teacher in an all-black school? Belle, I went to all-black schools until I was in the 9th grade. When I went to racially integrated schools and went to art classes, there were easels. Most of the white teachers were racist, but our high school art teacher was a cosmopolitan man. He wore black. That's one of the things I remember. Looking back, I see now that he, like my cousin Skylar, was almost like a caricature of an artist. But since he was the most cosmopolitan person I had ever encountered in my life, I associated all of that with art, freedom, independence of mind and being. Art class was the one place in high school where I felt liberated from the drive to be the perfect black student, always smart and uplifting my race. In art class, I could be whatever I wanted to be. He stressed that we could be whatever we wanted to be. One of his assignments was to have each of us choose an artist, study them, and try to paint in their tradition. In class, I learned about William de Kooning, and I chose to pattern my work after his. Later, I learned that other black people have had that relationship with de Kooning's work, and I've tried to think about why that is the case. Was it the colors that he chose? He used so many dark hues. Amalia, or that fact that he, like many modernists, quasi-contemporaries, really studied African art, and art from other parts of the world, and really integrated them, and those gestures could be seen in their painting. Belle, absolutely. But despite his support and interventions, my art teacher was seen as somewhat suspect. He was not a Southerner, and that set him even further apart from the other teachers. In high school, I really wanted to join this new world, and my parents told me, "Absolutely not. How will you make any money?" Amalia, by the time I left home to go to college, my parents knew I would be an artist, but they didn't want me to suffer. So we made a compromise. I agreed that I would study commercial art, which was very in vogue in the early 60s. Then, when no one was looking, I switched to painting. I don't think they realized it till I graduated. It didn't really prepare me for any kind of living, at least in that era. It did open up this whole wide world of people who were different. Belle, where was this, Amalia? Amalia, San Jose State University. I went first to a junior college for a couple of years, but then I went to San Jose State. It was very wild and bohemian, and there were no Mexicans except for maybe me. At that time, 20,000 students were enrolled there, and the school had a big Greek system with a lot of fraternities and sororities that were very, very white. Belle. Before I attended Stanford, I went to a white women's college in the Midwest. There, some of the depression I felt in my high school years, the suicidal depression, set in. It was about being an outsider and knowing I didn't fit in there. But my parents were pleased with this college because there were a lot of rules. Amalia, they liked the social controls. Belle, and I'd won a general scholarship. They could drive me there. It was a kind of finishing school in some ways. You didn't have to take art classes, but if you showed an interest, you could have an easel and you could paint. So I always had my own easel, and I would go to the studio to paint. Yet throughout college, all the people in that world were white men. It was the same at this women's college. Art remained a white, hegemonic world. So I began to get into theater, too. You've said that artistic endeavors, whether theater, visual arts, or creative writing, offered space for people of color to be ourselves. In so many ways, those spaces attracted the white folk who were outsiders and who didn't belong. Amalia, as you've been talking, I've been thinking how I didn't fit in with the Mexicans either. First off, I'm from a small family, and already people are wondering. Then, my first name is Maxine. Amalia is my middle name. Maxine? What kind of name is that? It's not a Mexican name. Is it the Andrews sisters? Is it Maximilian Carlotta? What is it? Belle, what was your mother thinking, Amalia? Amalia, she said it reminded her of a movie star's name, Maxine Messa. And in the 1930s and 1940s, I was born in 1943, Mexicans saw boxing and movie stardom as the way out. For Mexican girls like me, I called it the Dolores del Rio phenomenon. Years later, these images and entities are paramount to my own artwork because they came from my mother, giving me ideas about what I would be. So, Maxine Messa was supposed to be a movie star. Then, another mark against me. They didn't pierce my ears. They didn't want any piercing. I've never met a Mexican in my childhood that did not have pierced ears, except me. Belle, and wait, what was that about? Amalia, I don't know. No one's ever told me. And so, I had them pierced when I was 18. Belle, my mother and father were very opposed to piercing. We all longed to be pierced. Amalia, well, the first earrings Mexican girls wear are little baby crosses as infants. In retrospect, it was very clear that somebody had already decided that I wasn't going to be like the rest of the Mexicans. And as I got older, I feel like I located myself in a space in which I was not Mexican, but I could never be white. I know the language for it now, the interestus, or the space in between two spaces. So all of the peers that I ran around with in high school were the very popular white girls. But on the weekends and at home, my friends were Mexican kids who were related indirectly to my family through compadrajo, or godparentage. They were the children that my parents helped to baptize, and they all knew me. Belle, because I was seen as different and strange at home, I was being emotionally abused and at times whipped. Amalia, and did your parents do that because they were afraid that if you didn't learn to behave, things would be worse for you? Belle, absolutely. So the only way that I could escape censure was to be talented and win their approval for something. So I became very active in acting and debate and won lots of prizes. I painted, I did theater, I was on the debating team, and I was book smart as well. And because of my mother's class aspirations, she didn't want to be a backwoods person like her mother, I took piano and organ lessons. I was going to be a gifted, talented person on all fronts. I would know about appropriate manners and etiquette. I feel I was a part of a wave of working-class black people integrating the educational system in the U.S., and our parents were determined that we would be the best at everything. Amalia, it's almost like the talented tenth in a way. Belle, something like that. The idea of racial uplift was
sample complete. Ready to continue?